Yeah, you can hardly switch on the television without giving one poor vision or another, telling us how tough things are going to be in the next 10 years. And can we just put the microphone on?
No, I'm going to give you a PowerPoint.
Okay, I'm going to put my PowerPoint stuff
on. Make it nicer, make it even more interesting.
Okay. There you are. All right, very good. Okay.
There you go.
Okay, thank you. There's a kind of, there's many challenges. I mean, the first challenge is just that, let's not talk about public debt, let's talk about private debt. Britain has borrowed, and you know, people in this room, we have borrowed a lot of money. We are the private debt capital of the world. No other country has more residential mortgages, mortgages on commercial real estate, and consumer credit per capita or as a share of national output than us. And I'm going to put a graph up to show you that in a minute. We know that private debt, when it gets to the scale it's got to, more than three times our GDP, we know that in other countries who've got to that place, Japan for example, they can't go on. And actually the debt will have to be paid back a bit, or we have to stop borrowing and the economy has to grow, but the ratios have to get corrected one way or another. So that's got to happen in the next in the next 5 to 10 years. Also what's got to happen is that, and we have this big deficit of £163 billion in the current financial year, and I don't think, as I was saying to the interview of the BBC, and I think that we've got ourselves in a hysterical position about this as a country, about our public debt. Even in 2015, when public debt is going to peak on the government's plans, and it wants to halve the deficit, so that while it's high deficit, the debt goes up every year. Yeah? And when you get to 2015, that public debt will be about 75% of our GDP. Well, that's, you can be utterly relaxed about that. I mean, you couldn't be more relaxed. our debt's been higher than that since we won the 7 years war against the French in 1763. It was much higher than 75% of GDP. It went up to 300% during the Napoleonic Wars. It stayed very, very high throughout the 19th century. It began to fall towards the end, got a bit below 75. Went back above 75 when we got in the First World War, and stayed above it until the mid-70s and early 80s, when inflation solved the problem. When it gets up to 75%, and it will be lower than most of our modern history, it will be lower than the average for the G7. Economists get worried when you have to spend about more than 10% of your tax revenues of the country on debt service, and when you get about 15%, that's amber to red, that's worrying. In 2015, we'll be spending about 7 or 8% of GDP on debt service. So we can be completely relaxed. And the hysteria, from both parties about needing to cut this debt, I think is completely over the top. We could be more measured about it, because the danger for us is that we're going to cut this debt in the public sector, and we're going to cut our debt in the private sector. And if everyone's repaying their debts, the economy will grow very slowly. And the economy in the last 10 or 12 years has been very dependent upon financial services, the growth in property prices, people taking money out of their homes and spending it on foreign holidays, imported goods and services. Just look at the outskirts of Manchester, you can see the great warehouses and retail sheds where the stuff comes in from the container ports, paid for by you having an additional mortgage from Bradford and Bingley or Northern Rock. That's been the business model of the UK. We can't grow like that in the next 10 years, partly because we won't be able to borrow because we're paying off our debts, partly because our international accounts need to be put right as well. So we've got to do different things. And the exam question to the Liberal Democrats, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party in this general election should be, how is this country going to grow and generate jobs given what I've just said? How are you going to do it, David Cameron? How are you going to do it, Gordon Brown? How are you going to do it, Nick Clegg? And I hope that in these big debates we're going to have in the next 3 weeks, that actually the audience has asked our leaders those questions. So far, there hasn't been a very good answer from anybody. And last but not least, in jobs, this bubble economy that we generated, has meant that an enormous amount of tax revenue has been generated broadly in London and the South East, which has been spent in the rest of the country on public sector jobs. And I'm going to put a graph up showing you how dependent the rest of the country has been on the public sector generating its jobs, and that's true in the northwest. In Manchester, and particularly South Manchester and North Cheshire, that's not quite the story. It looks much more like, you know, the southeast, London and the southeast, just like part of the Golden Triangle does on the side of Pennines around Leeds. But those are literally the only parts of the country outside London where that's true. The rest of the country, it's been a devastating story of actually relying on the public sector. The West Midlands, without the public sector, would have actually, you know, run up the white flag. It would have been, you know, you'll see. So what I'm going to do is I just want to show you a few. And I am an economic commentator, so some of these graphs, for God's sake, you know, don't freak out. They're, all of them are easy to understand if you'll just bear with me. The second one you'll see is a bit astonishing, but again, don't freak out. You will be okay. You will survive. There will be coffee, and you will understand it. And it's important you do, because the second level what I want to say, and I've only got a few minutes left, is I think the challenge for the country and the national challenge is to build what I call an innovation architecture or an innovation ecosystem to support the growth of small and medium-sized firms, at the same time not to cut capital investment. We need to have an innovation revolution in the country. We have to have a huge build-up of investment if we're going to make our living in a different way in the next decade from the way we've done it in the last decade. That's pretty clear. Here, just a selection of these, and I can't show you them all. I realise I put a lot together. I hope you can see that. Can you see that? I know it's a graph, some of you won't find that familiar with this stuff, but that plots bank lending as a share of British GDP the last 125 years, well, I mean 130 years. From 1880 to 1980, for 100 years, broadly for every £100 of output, we had bank lending of about £50. Bank lending was about half our GDP. And then look what happened. Around the early 70s, it began to take off. And so by the early 90s, it was twice GDP. And that was pretty worrying. And then look what happened. After the Big Bang, right up until last year, bank assets went from twice GDP to more than five times GDP. It's unbelievable. There are only two countries in the world who've got bank lending, and that's not just in pounds, that's in yen, in euros, and in dollars, and Swiss francs. There are only two countries which have got more bank lending as a share of their output. You know who they are? Iceland and Ireland. The Americans, President Obama, Tim Geithner, his Treasury Secretary, that's good at the Chancellor's Exchequer, the President of the Federal Reserve, Michael Ben Bernanke, are all really worried about how big Citibank and Bank of America are. They think they're really, really too big for the American economy, which is 10 times our size. And here's another message. Royal Bank of Scotland, Barclays Bank, Lloyd Bank, and HSBC are all bigger than Bank of America and the Citigroup. The Americans think they've got too big, too complex banks. We've got four banks bigger than theirs, and our economy is one-tenth the size. Anyone who thinks that our banks are going to carry on growing in relation to Little Britain, in the next decade, you should be really worried. Boris Johnson, I had a debate with him in The Observer, he says, we must back the city. We've got to carry on. It's impossible. Because the amount of capital behind our banks has also been falling, by the way. If in 10 or 15 years I came back here and talked to you, and bank assets were 8, 9, 10 times British GDP, and there was another crisis, we would be overwhelmed as a country. We'd be overwhelmed as a country. And we'd be printing money, there'd be hyperinflation. The City of London is too big for our economy, and our big banks are too big for us. And the other point
All of you, if you're homeowners, know that your houses have doubled or trebled in value in the last. I saw how house prices going to Trafford, parts of Manchester compared with other parts. You have some very spectacular house price gains right here. That's all been financed by all of that. That's been a huge avalanche of mortgages to support that. Lending not twice, not three times, but five times your income has carried up those house prices. It can't happen anymore, see? And the one thing I can guarantee you is that house prices are not going to do very much in the years ahead. And all the industries that were built around that are not going to do very much in the years ahead. And this is the graph which is going to really, you know, make some people blink. And what I want you, just close your eyes, like you're in a horror movie, but don't get alarmed. Don't leave the room. It won't last long.
This is Britain. You can't see that from where at the back. But this is the amount of debt we've got as a share of our GDP. And you can see that it's the highest. This is private debt. That's mortgages. That's bank debt, because banks borrow. And that's business debt. Look at that. And look at that little public debt. It's tiny. Tiny, wee, wee top. Bigger than every other country in the world. That is, can't grow anymore. You know that from the previous graph, but it can't grow anymore. And really what's going to have to happen, I think, is this is going to have to fall as a share of GDP, and this public bit's got to increase. If you don't allow that to increase, we're going to have some bad times. And actually, that's what both parties are promising to a greater or lesser degree. And I mean, I really think the national debate is, you know, almost out to lunch on this. Here's the recession. This is the Gordon Brown effect. I mean, Gordon got a lot of things wrong in the last 10 or 12 years, but he did in the autumn of 2008 get one thing right. Here, this black line is the scale of the recession. And look, that brown line was what happened in the 30s. There was a period for about 12 months where actually there was such a deep dive in the economy, it was going worse than even in the 1939-30-31 period. Unbelievable. And it could have gone down there. That's what we're looking at. And that would have, I tell you what, you know, the unemployment would have been not peaked at 2.75 million, it had gone to 4 million. Everyone would have felt it. But actually, by saving the banks and boosting the economy, we've actually got a floor under it. And we aren't going to go like that. But, you know, economies are like corks. You press them as if you put a cork down a bath, and you take your hand off it, the cork comes back up to service quite quickly. The economy comes back up to service quite quickly. But then you have to ask, once it's come back to the service, what's going to happen after that? And what's going to happen after that is going to be, I think, some years of very, very slow growth. Now, there's some good news here. But before I get to the good news, you really can't see this, but I just want to show you, and I won't come downstairs like this, it's the last one come downstairs like this. This is where the jobs have come from, very fast. Look at this, in the northwest of England, 76%. So for every 100 jobs generated in the northwest in the last 10 years, 76 have come from the public sector. I repeat, 76 in the public sector. Now, actually, in Manchester, which has got quite a good knowledge economy, the figure is much closer to what it is in East Anglia and the South East. It's more like 55 or 60 jobs for every 100 that come from the public sector, but still the majority. Look at the West Midlands here. What happened in the West Midlands in the last 10 years is that private sector jobs fell by 60,000 and public sector jobs went up by 120,000. If you start seeing going to cut the deficit in 4 years, halve the deficit in 4 years, have pay freezes and austerity, I mean, what's going to happen to employment in places like this? What is going to happen? Everyone says, you know, hospitals and schools and universities, they're nice to have things, but they're basically not part of the wealth generating sector, is what we always hear. Absolutely wrong. Hospitals and universities these days, and what the Americans call EDs and MEDs, are crucial parts of the wealth-generating sector. The University of Manchester generates wealth.
So does the hospitals around here. They generate wealth by actually making you well and teaching you stuff, which is what you want. That's all that wealth is, in the same way that driving an Audi A6 is quite pleasant. It's wealth generating. See what I mean? It's not a burden. This whole kind of discourse, I think, is wrong. These are just two graphs where I just describe how the knowledge economy has been the thing that's helped us out of this. And I want to introduce you, because I've only got a few more minutes, to this idea of the knowledge economy. When I talk about the knowledge economy, people say, oh my God, what that means is, you know, a university lecturer, or, you know, a woman in a white coat in a laboratory, you know, developing a new vaccine or drug. It's got nothing to do with me. Now, I'm going to have a show of hands, because I suspect people in here will be disproportionately what we at the Work Foundation and what the economists call knowledge workers. That's to say, you probably got a diploma, college diploma, a professional qualification, A-levels, or a degree. If you're in any of those four categories, will you raise your hand, please? That's what I thought. If you're not in that category, can you raise your hand? Thank you very much. And so, can I ask you what you do during the day?
Strategic engagement
worker. Yeah, I would call you a knowledge worker. And so, everyone in this room is a knowledge worker. Well, of course you are. And that's why you come. Because, and actually, Magister, as I'm going to show you, is actually rather strong in the knowledge economy. But over the last 35 years, and the portion of the workforce who are knowledge workers has gone up from 1/5 to 2/5. And in the next 30 years, they're going to go up to 3/5. And you know, the brute truth of our economy is that actually universities, and I was listening to your ambition about what you want to do with Magister. I mean, Magister is in the top 50. There are other universities like Edinburgh who claim they're number 5 in the country instead of Leeds. But Magister is there or thereabouts as one of the one of the top 10 and one of the top 8 universities in Britain, and actually one of the top 8 within the top 70 or 80 in the world. It's a major asset. But that's not all that you need to be kind of an asset in the knowledge economy. I'm going to describe that. I'm keenly aware I've only got about 5 more minutes. Could you bear with me if I take 10 minutes? I mean, because it does take a little while to get through this stuff, and I hope it will help you in the second half of the evening. This just now. Here you are. These are all the industries which are knowledge industries. Hands up, people who work in health and education in this audience. And there you are, you're all knowledge workers. Hands up who works in high-tech or high-tech manufacturing. Anyway, that's interesting. There's quite a strong high-tech manufacturing sector, aren't there? Who works in telecoms, computer services, R&D? Anyone? Who works in financial services? Well done. Who works in business services, real estate, advertising, accountancy, legal, technical, consultancy, financial facilities, all that stuff? Can I raise your hands? Interesting. Who works in the culture and creative industries? Well, what we've got here, I suspect, a lot of people who are working in the non-knowledge economy, about half of you, well, actually, what this about corresponds to the, I would have thought that given your qualifications, that most of you would have worked in the knowledge economy. This is about half or 2/3 of the knowledge economy. Who works in low-tech manufacturing? No, but they've got no people working in manufacturing in this audience. That's interesting. Look, I'll move on. I won't go too much. Might discover things I don't want to hear. When I talk about knowledge economy, people say, oh, Will Hutton, you know, we don't understand a bloody thing. What are you talking about? And I like to talk to them about intangibles and about tangibles. Now, everyone knows when you walk around a factory that, you know, there's machines making stuff. You know, in an office, you can see a PC, a computer on a desk, which people are manipulating. That's a tangible. You can touch it. Intangibles are intangible. You can't see them. It's R&D. It's non-scientific R&D, like design or advertising. It's teaching. It's the ICT. Computer software is an intangible. And here's what can happen to intangibles. And they have doubled, the investment in intangibles by business has doubled in the last 35 years. And you know why that's happened? Because you as consumers, all of you, are getting more discerning, more demanding about what you want from goods and services. Companies are being able to offer that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm a baby boomer. You know, when we went to the movies, you weren't served coffee and chocolate brownies as we can in some Odeons now. You know, flying on an aeroplane is a completely different experience, unless you get EasyJet. But even that's actually quite. But what I'm trying to say is that actually, whether it's a car you drive, whether it's clothes you wear, whether it's your haircut, all of us are more demanding about it. We're more demanding about our experience at work, and we're more demanding of the consumers of actually what companies are supplying us. And consequently, companies have to invest in that stuff. And they also want workers who are close to their consumers, who understand consumers, who understand their markets, who can work with their teammates, who can problem solve. That's the kind of people who employers like these days. And actually, I want to show you, look at this.
When this recession began, the Daily Mail said, this is a white-collar recession. It's not a white-collar recession at all. This is 84% of job loss in the first 18 months were manual workers and unskilled workers. Only 7% of knowledge workers lost their jobs. This audience haven't really been losing work very much in this recession. It's been the unskilled. And you can see that in the job numbers in the Northwest too.
But this part economy, this knowledge part economy, is the bit that's going to get us out of recession. And I'm going to spend 5 minutes on this and I'm going to wrap it up. Because this is quite fun, this bit. I don't suppose any of you have ever heard of a general purpose technology. But that's what's generated wealth over the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. The first general purpose technology was when you could domesticate animals. The next one is the wheel. One of my favourite general purpose technologies is the three-masted sailing ship. Because when the Port Spanish invented that, they were able to sail across the Atlantic to South America, discover all that silver and gold, bring it back to Europe. That's why Latin America speaks Spanish and Portuguese, because they were the first two countries to develop the three-master sailing ship. You can sail outside of land with three masts because you can get close to the wind. The printing press, the railway, think of an amazing thing. The railway is not just a gateway to be. Without the railway, you don't have suburbs. Without the railway, you couldn't have a nation state. Without the railway, we couldn't have had mass war and mass death in the way that we did. The American Civil War was the first war fought with railways. My God. And in our century, there's been 9 of these. The internet, the internal combustion engine. But look at how they've grown. There were 2 of them in the between 1400 and 1750. By 1750 and 1900. Actually, over the last 600 years, there have been 16 general purpose technologies. Now, who in this room is under 30? Now, all of you will see in your lifetime more general purpose technologies than we've seen since 1750. And you're going to see some of the most startling innovation. Innovation upon innovation upon innovation. In an old people's home, and remember, when you're in an old people's home in 60 years' time, you're under 30s, remember this, because I'm going to tell you that you will be witnessing commercial space travel. We'll be getting precious earths, some of the minerals we need to have nuclear fusion from other planets. When we talked about this to the Technology Strategy Board, the man who runs it is number 2 in IBM. He said, in the 22nd century, we're going to be disaggregating material. That's what you mean. We're going to be breaking down material and re-aggregating it. And he said, it'll be commonplace. I said, so what, you could disaggregate an animal and reassemble it? He said, by the time I get to 2150, it's almost certain. So I said, so Star Trek isn't nonsense? I mean, beam me up, Scotty. I mean, it'll be the children of the people in this room, or the grandchildren in this room, who are under 30 will live to see that. And that's what's going to generate wealth. That's what's going to generate wealth. These are a list of all the things that are going to be that are coming down the path. I gave this talk or a similar talk, and I put on GPTs in Singapore a couple of years ago. And the guy who advises Lee Kuan Yew said to me, I was the only Westerner who'd ever come to Singapore talking about general purpose technologies, because we don't talk about this in the UK. I mean, imagine in one of the three debates, you know, Brown or Clegg or David Cameron talking in these terms. Imagine them talking about the investment in science and technology that's required. And also, imagine them thinking about, I'm going to just go back to that, an innovation ecosystem. This is what you're going to build to deliver it. This is just a little bit of typology here of how you actually get ideas like that into the kind of bloodstream of an economy. But we don't have that. Here are some of the sectors. The pace of change in this, and why look at the future when you can? It's obvious about the past. I mean, in 1955. 7 out of 10 men cycled home for lunch, and 7 out of 10 women cooked it for them. And when they retired at the age of 60, they would get a gold watch, and their life expectancy would be 70. Today in 2010, who cycles home for lunch? And certainly no woman cooks it for the man. And the firm they're working for is probably likely to go out of business within 11 years, because the life cycle of the firms is actually, you know, they grow, they peak, and they become superseded very quickly these days. It's a much riskier environment in which we all live. But here are some of the sectors that we could do well in as a country. The low carbon economy, culture and creative industries, high tech business services, and a new sector that are where manufacturing combines with services, we call them manu services, in some of the industries in which we're quite strong. AstraZeneca, there's no one working here in AstraZeneca, I guess, but that's going to be a big part in North Cheshire. But that's a big, big, and aerospace actually is a big industry around here. That's going to carry on growing. So look, here's my essential point. Don't get too despair. Here's the intensity of in Manchester,
I said health insurance.
Textiles, Oldham, Rochdale, quite a lot of high tech manufacturing. I mean, a lot of it in aerospace. So, you know, there's a base on which to build there. If you could construct in Manchester a Mancunian version of the national innovation ecosystem we need to develop to support our manufacturing companies. And here's the story about knowledge-intensive services. You can see how Salford and Imagine itself, how dense that is. That's 60% of all the employment in Salford and Manchester is knowledge-intensive services. And and that will spread into Trafford and Stockport, I think, in the next decade or 15 years, if we have the investment, and if we can construct the innovation ecosystem that will support firms in Rochdale, Oldham, and Tenside, and the manufacturing ones, and the service ones, in Salford and Manchester. That is the economic task for Manchester. And to do it, you're going to have an innovation ecosystem looks like that. You're going to have entrepreneurs coming forward, lots of ideas coming from universities, lots of ways in which those men and women can get together, a selection process. A lot of the people around here are going to be early adopters of the very clever ideas they come up with. You're going to ship them out to Liverpool, which is going to be a burgeoning kind of port if this gets right. You are going to have a huge avalanche of investment in new skills from your colleges. You're going to have local networks of new banks, specialist banks, banking to these young companies, exploit these amazing new technologies. You're going to have a second industrial revolution here in Manchester, or you could have. You could have, if actually the politicians started talking about some other things that you have to have. And I,
put here a list of things. You can't read them probably, but there's a list of things which I think we need to kind of construct in Britain. But I've shown this to Vince Cable, I've shown this to David Cameron, and I've shown this to David Miliband and Peter Mandelson. So it's not as if they don't know about it. And actually, the politicians are moving a bit towards this. I mean, some of the things that I suggested, like some new financial institutions, both the Tories and Labour are supporting. both of them are talking about developing technology transfer institutes to help transfer ideas from our intellectuals and scientists and technologists in our universities to the business community. But actually, if you ask them the question, are they trying to build an innovation architecture, look at you with an open mouth, really. And if you're going to start a company or a business here, I mean, if this is Taiwan, if this is California, if this was Munich, if this was Helsinki, if this was Seoul in South Korea, you know, and you wanted to get some business off the ground, you'd know what the system was to support you. We don't bloody have one. No one's got a bloody idea. Our banks are just out to lunch. £1.8 trillion lent in sterling, 1.2 on mortgages, £350 billion in commercial property, £150 billion in consumer credit. Only £100 billion of £1.8 trillion is lent to business. I mean, bloody hell. We have, and of course we have a bubble economy. And of course all the jobs come from the public sector. And of course we're in a bloody corner as a country. Because you've got to change that stuff. So, there's a lot more to say. I just think, just to wrap up, there's a lot more I could show you, but there's not enough time. I do think, you know, the story is about, you know, we want lots of productive entrepreneurs. Moulton, you know, the guy who started Moulton Bikes, one of the biggest bike manufacturers in Europe, 25,000 bikes a year. You want, you know, that's down in London. Dyson's done quite a good job building these Hoovers. You know, we want hundreds of these men and women to come forward, not just, you know, count them on the fingers of one hand. We've got to build institutions that support them. We have not got to talk about self-flagellating, self-damaging public expenditure cuts, in particular cutting capital investment, when actually, as you've just shown you, we are all so highly borrowed. We need a new bargain at work, in my view. I mean, all of you are knowledge workers, all of you have got these qualifications. You know, actually, I think we're going to have to get smarter still, and smarter again, about the way we do our work. Because so many of the firms in which you work in the private sector are going to have these short life histories. And I think, this is my view, is that we should develop a system. I can't believe unemployment insurance. I mean, if it's true that firms, you know, have shorter life histories than they used to, people are going to have transitional unemployment many more times in their life. Try living on job seekers' allowance of £65.40 a week, eh? If you're making £25,000 a year or something, £30,000 a year, if you're a knowledge worker, maybe £40,000 or £50,000 a year, going down to live on, you know, £60,000 or £40,000 a week, ain't clever. I think we need to develop a system of employment insurance in Britain. And we should actually and we should all pay 3%, 4%, 5% of our salaries into a kind of mutual insurance companies who, if we get out of work, will pay us 90% of our wages while we look for new work or while we invest in our skills for the next opportunity. And by the way, life expectancy these days, I mean, I'm nearly 60, my life expectancy as a man is 85, for Christ's sake. And some of the people under 30, the women under 30, their life expectancy is over 90. A baby girl being born from a professional home, her life expectancy is 93, 94. And people are going to have enormously long working lives. The idea they could have knocked off at 60 and spent 35 years looking at the wall, you know. We've got to start talking, I think, of having later retirement. And one of the ways, by the way, you solve this public sector, this deficit we've got, is by saying, come on, let's get fresh. I mean, we baby boomers, I mean, we've had a gilded life. All this equity we've made in our homes, that was just because all you banks lent a lot of money. No virtue for us doing that. You know, we've had largely full employment. Our kids are going encumbered by debt. Much different. Of course we should retire later.
Of course you should retire later. Save the public some money. Rather than self-gratulating and actually bears the Tories, they have suggested that. They have suggested having retired at 66 in 2016, not talking much about it, but they have talked about it. And, you know, if we put this together, there's a second industrial revolution. And I think for Manchester, what you should be talking about tonight is actually, we talk about the economy, you want to talk about how you and Manchester are going to construct your innovation ecosystem, how it's going to mesh with the national one, how you are going to sustain capital investment in this city, how you are going to organise housing and transport so it serves this knowledge economy. Because actually Manchester, after London, and I really do believe this, you know, this, you know, was the second city during the Empire. It has such an opportunity at the moment. You know, it can, this stuff gets it right, it can ride it, it can become a very rich city and a very nice place to live and be. It's just pretty nice at the minute, but the next 5 or 10 years could set it back, and instead of which we should take that kind of crisis and turn it into an opportunity. Thank you very much. Thank you.